Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Rabin with the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques, who talks about the continued resistance to Navy bombing maneuvers on the Puerto Rican island. Gregory Palast, a columnist with the London Observer newspaper, who assesses European resistance to President Bush's environmental and defense policies seen during his recent trip to the continent. And Steve Weissman, legislative representative with Public Citizens Congress Watch, who discusses the continuing battle for passage of campaign finance reform legislation in Congress. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Victims of the violence in East Timor that followed the Pacific Islands' 1999 independence vote told their stories of horror in an American courtroom in March as part of a civil suit against top Indonesian General Johnny Lumintang. According to the East Timor Action Network, a U.S.-based human rights group, five victims and their families sued General Lumintang under the 1992 Torture Victims Protection Act that allows anyone to use American courts to seek justice for violations of the law of nations or a treaty with the United States. The lawsuit filed last year by several John and Jane Does, who are concealing their identities, charged General Lumintang, who is now the Secretary General of the Indonesian Ministry of Defense, with gross human rights abuses and crimes against humanity in East Timor. General Lumintang did not respond to the lawsuit. The crux of the case hinges on two documents that General Lumintang signed. On May 5, 1999, he sent a telegram to senior military officers with the order to enforce repressive, coercive measures, including an evacuation plan if East Timorese voters endorsed independence. In addition, General Lumintang approved a special forces handbook that instructed Indonesian soldiers in committing acts of terror, kidnapping, and sabotage. An expert witness, Professor Richard Tanter, says the documents showed that top Indonesian military officers played a key role in planning, promoting, and in aiding deadly attacks by pro-Indonesian militias, which led to the death of 1,500 East Timorese and the destruction of 75% of the local infrastructure. Tens of thousands of refugees still remain in dangerous camps in neighboring West Timor. The political race to be the next mayor of New York City is already underway. Four well-funded Democrats, public advocate Mark Green, city comptroller Alan Hevesy, city council president Peter Vallone, and Bronx borough president Fernando Ferrer, are lining up to replace Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who is retiring due to term limits. But according to The Nation magazine, none of the Democrats has energized progressive voters nor defined a new issue agenda to move the Big Apple forward. Mark Green worked for Ralph Nader during the 1970s, but critics charge the other Democrats are all graduates of machine politics, eager to deliver perks to party loyalists and a track record of cutting deals with Giuliani and his Republican operatives in City Hall. Another reason for this non-issue race is the collapse of reform politics and independent political clubs that used to challenge the status quo. Longtime liberal activist Russell Hemingway of the Coalition of Democratic Voters lamented, "The reform movement is dead and the Democratic left is barely alive." Some progressives see potential in Ferrer's attempt to create a Black-Latino alliance to win City Hall. But many organizers are skeptical about grassroots energy behind Ferrer's campaign. Angelo Falcon of the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund remarked that Ferrer is trailing because he is a traditional insider who does not know how to organize people of color, even though the majority of the city is now non-white. Lesbian author Amber Hollibaugh startled some of the book browsers at a Manhattan Barnes & Noble store while on tour last fall when she declared over the store's public address system, "I have lived on the wrong side of sex since birth. This is both who I am and who I was meant to be." For nearly 30 years, Hollibaugh has broken the boundaries of sex and politics. According to the Progressive magazine, she had worked for civil rights, gay rights, and now prisoners' rights, but always struggled to find her place among leftist academics and AIDS activists. Hollibaugh defied sexual boundaries early in the 1990s when she started the first lesbian AIDS project in the country. Working with gay men's health crisis in New York, Hollibaugh collected data and handed out safe sex kits to women. The Lesbian AIDS effort trained poor women as outreach workers, some of whom were infected with AIDS or living on welfare. Recently, Haliwo has tried to halt the drift of gay life into mainstream society. In a letter to gay organizations, she urged a return to the heady spirit of the early days of gay liberation. Haliwo observed, "What's normal and who defines that is fundamentally political." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
One day after the U.S. Navy resumed military exercises on June 18th, using dummy bombs on the tiny island of Vieques off the coast of Puerto Rico, 40 protesters have been arrested, including Jackie Jackson, the wife of Reverend Jesse Jackson. The group had entered the firing range demanding an immediate end to the military maneuvers. 8 of these protesters had landed by boat just before the start of the bombing. Last week, President Bush had announced that the Navy would leave Vieques in 2003, the same time frame slated by President Clinton. But many island residents and even the governor of Puerto Rico have rejected the proposal and are demanding an immediate halt to the bombing exercises. A referendum about the Navy exercises previously brokered by President Clinton and former Puerto Rican Governor Pedro Rosello is scheduled for November. Puerto Ricans have also scheduled a non-binding vote in July. However, Navy Secretary Gordon R. England has asked Congress to cancel the November referendum, stating that it sets a very bad precedent. Robert Rabin is a protest organizer and member of the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques. He spoke with Between the Lines' Denise Manzari.
During the day and during several days previous, we had about 40 people who got inside the restricted area into the impact zone. This held up bombing that was supposed to begin on Monday in the morning at 8 o'clock. Did not begin, and it didn't begin at 9 or 10. Then they said they'd do it at 11, but they couldn't. And at 12, they also didn't. It was pushed to 1, and they couldn't start because there were people in the bombing zone. And then at 2, they finally determined that they would start shooting anyway. There were people still in the bombing area, in the restricted zone. Apparently, they did some overflights, dropped some bombs between 2 and 3, and then had to stop again. Later that day, there were some arrests, and at 10 o'clock last night, the Navy started up again its exercises somewhere around 7 or 8 at night. And at 10, they had to stop again to arrest a group of about 7 people, mainly young Viequenses, in a group called the Vieques Youth United.
Navy spokespeople have stated that the delay in the exercises had nothing to do with protesters, but more Navy scheduling. How would you respond to that?
Well, the Navy lies. Navy, to the people of Vieques and about Vieques, that we have 60 years of experience of Navy lies and deceit. They certainly do not want to admit that this small community of 9,000 people is capable of breaking through their supposedly high-tech, impassable security, and that's going on constantly here, where people go through the perimeter fence, people in fishing boats have got onto beaches, despite an amazing amount of military presence and high-tech radars and heat-sensing devices. Over 30 people now have been arrested inside the Navy's restricted area. People have been brought to the federal court in San Juan. There have been a large number of people who have refused to pay bail in the process, and for that reason have been sent to the federal penitentiary, the federal prison in San Juan.
Can you talk a little bit about this past Father's Day? There was a virtual sit-in.
There was a lot of things happening over the past several days. On Father's Day, we certainly did denounce the fact that dozens of Puerto Rican fathers and fathers from Vieques were in prison Father's Day. So many families here were without their fathers on an important day. That means a lot to family unity here. There was also a virtual sit-in over the past several days organized by a group of solidarity group in the Boston area. And this was a project basically designed or aimed at the recruiting system of the Navy, and that was also very successful. The people from the recruiting stations called the organizers of this event and asked them to please put an end to their action because it was causing great difficulties with the computer systems.
Last week, President Bush basically reiterated, I believe, what you can say was a deal brokered between President Clinton and then Governor of Puerto Rico, Pedro Rosselló, that the Navy would stop bombing in 2003. But the people of Vieques and on the main island of Puerto Rico don't accept that. Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, the demands of the people here are for the immediate and permanent cessation of all military activity. That's not met by, those demands are not met by Bush's decision. So we will continue the protest, continue the civil disobedience action.
If you look at the website of the Navy and you also hear some of the responses by critics of the protesters, for example, they say that there's a very small area of Vieques that's occupied, it's at least 8 miles away from any residential area, and that environmental destruction has been minimal, and that they care about the people of Vieques and exercise the utmost care in doing these exercises. What is your response to that?
The Navy lies. There is overwhelming evidence that the 60 years of bombing, jets, ships, tanks, mortars, bazookas, experimentation with new weapon systems, inviting NATO countries here to bomb as well, the use of napalm, the use of depleted uranium weaponry, the destruction to coral reefs, to mangrove lagoons, to habitat of endangered species. All of this is well documented, as well as the intense contamination with heavy metals, RDX, and again, things like uranium. So it's very cynical of the Navy to try to present themselves as defenders of the environment here.
What is the next step for the protesters?
We'll continue with the civil disobedience actions here, and we'll also continue to lobby in Washington to continue the internationalization of the process. This week we have our delegate Ismael Guadalupe leaving tomorrow for New York. He'll participate in the upcoming United Nations Decolonization Committee hearings where he will bring up the topic of Vieques.
One last question, Robert. Navy Secretary Gordon England has asked Congress to cancel the November referendum, stating that it's bad public policy and sets a very bad precedent.
Well, the November referendum was a Navy invention, so it certainly doesn't mean much for us to have that referendum canceled. It's a referendum that does not in any way meet the needs of the people of Vieques. It's a referendum that was invented by the Navy for the Navy. The Navy admitted that they created that referendum with the purpose of trying to change people's opinions here, and the offer of $90 million to do so is part of that process. So we're not really concerned about this referendum.
That was Robert Rabin of the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques. For more information, contact the committee by calling area code 787-741-0716. Or visit their website at www.viequeslibre.org. Tens of thousands of demonstrators greeted President Bush on his first official trip to Europe last week. At issue, in the streets and among European leaders, was President Bush's controversial plan to build a national missile defense system, his passion for capital punishment, and the White House rejection of the Kyoto Protocol limiting greenhouse gases. Militant protests in Gothenburg, Sweden against Bush and the policies of the European Union meeting there ended in street battles where three demonstrators were shot by police. Mr. Bush is perceived in much of Europe as a shallow extremist, with little credibility given the many questions surrounding the 2000 U.S. presidential election, eventually decided in a partisan Supreme Court. But America's corporate press largely dismissed European unease with Mr. Bush, chalking up their objections to snobbishness and anti-Americanism. Despite a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, where the two leaders exchanged handshakes and smiles, little was said that reduces Europe's fears about the consequences of Bush's pledge to scrap the anti-ballistic missile treaty. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gregory Palast, a columnist with the London Observer newspaper who examines European resistance to President Bush's environmental and defense policies.
What you're seeing is a real fear that this guy is acting in what they call that he's a unilateralist. And what that means is that basically he says, okay, here's what I'm going to do. Now, Europe, roll over and play dead. You're just our kind of toy pet poodle. And they don't like that. They don't like being told, we're going ahead with Star Wars, we're kicking, we're canning the ABM treaty, whether you like it or not, and then we're going to, and we want you to put radar in the middle of the British Midlands. Yeah, they might even go along with some of this stuff eventually, but it looks, to their public, it looks like a new American dictatorship.
What about the papers here? It seems that the United States press is really downplaying the fear and disappointment with what passes for political leadership here in the United States by saying that Europeans are expected to give our new president a hard time. You know, it seems like they're soft-pedaling the criticism. Why do you think that is?
Well, because I think that there's some jingoism. There is some European arrogance that the American press is kind of dumbed down as well as the American president. And there may be some reason for it. Like, these guys do fly over to Europe, and they write these reports based on press conferences held by the State Department. And they say, look how nice Putin and Bush are together. Well, yeah, I mean, Putin doesn't, pull out a salami and hit George W. over the head with it and say, the guy's a jerk. What he says is, we can't go along. And you have to understand, the European leaders of both the center-right and center-left parties unanimously issued a declaration saying that they regretted the position of the President of the United States on global warming. Now, you have to understand, in diplomatic terms, when you unanimously regret the position of someone, that's kind of like taking a wee-wee on their shoes. I mean, that's about as insulting and nasty as you can get in diplomatic language and still remain an ally and not go to war. That's not nice stuff, and that was unanimous. That was not the left wing, and that was not the right wing. That was both wings getting together and saying, we got to block this guy. And that's not very good. You have to remember also that Europe does not have a sense of Bush as the legitimate president. You know, we've all forgiven and forgotten in America the election. But in Europe, there was much, much more coverage of the black voters being removed in Florida. There's a sense that this guy was not really elected president. They know he lost the popular vote. He's not a legitimate president in their eyes, so he doesn't come over with any authority.
Gregory, maybe we could briefly just visit each of these major issues with which European leaders have so many problems. Let's first of all go to the death penalty.
Bill Clinton favored the death penalty, and there were no demonstrations about that. But Bush is seen as a guy who seems to have fallen in love with the electric chair. And, the horrible stories about electrocuting retarded people and things. You have to understand, in Europe, state-sponsored death has a very bad history. They don't like it. And it is outlawed by the European Union. You can't join the European Union unless you eliminate the death penalty. So to them, it's a very sensitive issue. Yeah, there are Europeans who wouldn't mind a very limited death penalty. George Bush is a special case because it looks like he's almost, he's got a date with the hangman every other week. And that looks very bad. It gives Americans a very bloodthirsty, barbaric look. I mean, luckily, we're not, not every American is tainted with these policies. That's the other thing, is that they're not, I have to say, they don't blame Americans per se for their president.
Maybe you could speak to the depth of the concern in Europe about the U.S. bowing out of the Kyoto Treaty.
Don't forget that the Kyoto Accord, the ABM Treaty, all these things that George W. is kicking aside, they were his daddy's policies. He's actually overturning not Clinton administration policy, but George Herbert Walker Bush policies. There's an image of this guy being unlike his father, who is not disliked, by the way, in Europe, that the sun is really way off the edge, and knocking the Kyoto Treaty is like in America the equivalent of burning the flag. You just don't do it. And I don't care whether you're right wing or left wing, that's an issue. That's motherhood and apple pie. And now I don't know how these guys really feel. A lot of these guys are a bit hypocritical, these leaders, but they know that Bush has embarrassed them in front of their electorate. That's what happened in Spain, where you have a center-right government which is automatically sympathetic to Bush. And he immediately comes in and starts talking Star Wars and bombs and heating up the atmosphere, and you guys should love it. And you add on top of that, oh, by the way, I speak Spanish, but I can't even say your president's name. They're not too hot on that approach. So what George Bush may have done without wanting to do so is unify Europe in a way that the Europeans could never agree on doing.
That was Gregory Palast, a columnist with the London Observer newspaper. Read his columns online at www.gregpalast.com. Supporters of campaign finance reform legislation celebrated a hard-fought victory in April when the U.S. Senate passed the McCain-Feingold bill. After a summer recess, campaign finance legislation will be considered in the House of Representatives, where it has passed twice before. But the House Republican leadership has vowed to kill the bill with poison pill amendments or in any House-Senate conference. The House legislation named for Connecticut GOP Representative Chris Shays and Massachusetts Democratic Congressman Marty Meehan parallels the McCain-Feingold bill with a ban on unregulated soft money contributions made to political parties by corporations, unions, and individuals. The measure would also restrict TV and radio issue advertising referring to specific candidates within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general election. But an unusual coalition of advocacy groups on the left and the right, including the National Rifle Association and the AFL-CIO, oppose limits on political speech. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Steve Weissman, legislative representative with Public Citizens Congress Watch, who discusses the obstacles still standing in the way of passage of campaign finance reform legislation.
The McCain-Feingold bill has passed the Senate, and the Shays-Meehan bill will be taken up by the House right after the July 4th recess. Both bills have strong similarities. The heart of both bills is they ban soft money, unlimited contributions to political parties from corporations, unions, and wealthy individuals. They also curb ads that are claiming to be issue ads, but they're really campaign ads that are disguised campaign ads. They would eliminate probably about three-quarters of $1 billion in big contributions from the political process.
Now, the big obstacle in the past has been the U.S. Senate, but even under Republican leadership, it did get by. It seems like there's some trouble brewing in the House of Representatives, despite the fact that the Shays-Meehan bill did pass a couple of years in a row in the House of Representatives.
That's right. There's a couple of items of trouble. Well, first, I mean, there's three, really. First, Republicans in the House who oppose the bill, particularly the Republican leadership, wants to find a way to kill the bill. Even though they've lost a couple of times in the past, they're trying to exploit potential divisions among the Democrats and find some amendments that would perhaps make the bill very different from the Senate bill. Then that would force a conference with the Senate. And in a conference, the House Republican leaders who don't like the bill would control the appointment of people from the House side, and they feel they could kill the bill that way. So they're really trying to see if they can get some changes in the bill, even though they can't overcome the whole bill, that would make it easy to kill. And then in the Democratic side, there are reservations among many Democrats about a change that was occurred in the Senate bill where they increased the amount that an individual can give to a candidate, so-called hard money, regulated money, from $1,000 per election to $2,000 per election. This is controversial. A lot of people in the House, particularly people who cannot get that many of these larger contributions, even at 1,000, feel that 2,000 will exclude many people from the political process and may work some disadvantage to them as candidates. So that's a major problem that's emerged. And a final problem that's emerged in the House has been that some people are, particularly in the Congressional Black Caucus, are worried that without soft money, the political parties, particularly the Democratic Party, won't spend as much on voter turnout and voter registration since some of that was funded with soft money in the past.
What are some of your concerns about this McCain-Feingold bill and the the Shays-Meehan bill as things stand right now without the amendments? Do you at Public Citizen have some reservations about the direction this legislation has taken?
Well, we oppose the increase to $2,000 from $1,000 for individual contributions to candidates. We think wealthy people have too much influence. But in general, we still support strongly the McCain-Feingold bill in the Senate and the Shays-Meehan bill in the House. And we feel that it's important for the Shays-Meehan people to kind of work to create a similar bill, to make sure the bill that emerges is similar to McCain-Feingold so there can be avoiding a conference and we can eventually get a bill. If there's a conference, the bill is dead. So we basically think the process so far has worked. What happened in the Senate, the $2,000 thing, would have been $3,000 without a lot of people working against it. And it was wanted by Democrats as well as Republicans. But it was the number of Republicans who came on the bill was kind of their price for supporting getting this $750 million of soft money type finances out of the political process. We feel that we can't really push the Senate. That was what the Senate was willing to do. They have a filibuster there. A minority can destroy a bill. That's the only way we could get out of the filibuster. But it's still a very good bill, and we'd like a bill similar to that to be adopted by the House. Then the Senate could just accept the House bill, no conference. It would be going to the president. Bush has now indicated he will sign whatever comes out of Congress. So we could have campaign finance reform for the 2002 election if the House, while having some input on the bill, doesn't do anything unacceptable to the Senate.
That was Steve Weissman, legislative representative with Public Citizens Congress Watch. Contact Public Citizen by calling area code 202-546-4996 or visit their website at www.citizen.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.